Friday. This is Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. So every 3 or 4 months, whether you need it or not, we need to have Russell Blake come in and talk to us and just tell us the way it is. I want to let you know that I was gratefully given a copy of The Day After Never, the first book, which is called Blood Honor, Russell's new dystopian thriller, and it's absolutely fabulous. I don't think it's that much of a departure for him. It is, actually, but here to talk about that, the small Central American country he overthrew early in the year and then gave it back, is Russell Blake. Hey, Russ, how are you?
Hey, Pam, how are you?
Good. So you didn't like living in Central America that much other than being in Baja. So you gave the country back. It was just a real shithole.
Yeah, because the people, you know, I love the people. I just do for the people, which you know.
I know. I know that very well. You told me the castle was not to your liking, though.
Yeah, the stone floors, you know, I don't know. I was just sort of like, I thought it was going to be different.
I know. You said it's not oceanfront either. What's up
with
that?
Exactly. I mean, what am I supposed to do with that? And you know what? There was no place to park the helicopter. It got really, yeah.
Okay.
No, people don't understand how I suffer.
They really don't. And speaking of which, how you struggled to get readers for your over 40 books now. Congratulations on the release of The Day After Never. I love the premise for the book, but I especially like where you got the name. Are you willing to dish about that?
Sure. You know, I had actually just – it came to me in a dream. I was thinking, you know, that it would be kind of cool because, you know, people always go, oh, that can never happen. This can never happen. Right. That's unlikely. And I was just thinking, well, you know, what happens when the impossible happens? And, you know, what happens the next day? And obviously that's a metaphor because the book takes place 5 years post-collapse. But it's kind of – I thought it would be interesting to pick up the story basically after the disastrous event rather than wallowing through the entire disastrous event. And, you know, that's a different book. I didn't want to write that book.
I appreciate the fact that this wasn't an EMP that has crippled the world. This wasn't a nuclear attack. This was something that we actually have seen throughout the generations and the decades with a pandemic.
Yeah, a pandemic. And what I found interesting was let's take a pandemic and let's mesh it with the ensuing sort of economic collapse that would happen when, you know, suddenly the world is paralyzed by something like the Spanish flu. Only, you know, imagine if the Spanish flu had, you know, happened during the jet age. Like that's kind of what sort of gave me the idea because, I mean, there were no jets. There were no real planes, you know. So the Spanish flu was relatively contained, and it stopped world – it ended World War One. I mean, that's what ended it. Neither side could actually mount a battle anymore because all their soldiers were dying and sick. So now imagine if that happened during the jet age where, you know, over a period of 48 hours, you know, it just sort of swept the globe. And then imagine what that does to your financial system. So all of a sudden, you know, I mean, all of your systems are disrupted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I just found it fascinating if you could get both the idea of an economic collapse and a pandemic sort of, you know, dovetail together so that you get a 1-2 punch and it's a knockout blow. So that, really that was the whole idea.
And then every system collapses along with it. Obviously, and I think we've seen this more often, just historically we've seen that the bad guys take over the good guys because the bad guys are more ruthless. They're tougher. They're better armed. They terrorize people. So
yeah, they're more willing to do whatever it takes to seize power. We see that, you know, with warlords in Somalia, you know, and
sure.
Chad, you just see, you know, look, you know, there's this weird conceit that, you know, we are completely different than we were 100 or 200 or 300 years ago, or when the Mongol hordes were coming over the hill or the barbarians were at the gate. And yet we're not. We're the same. We're the same creatures. We're not that many generations, you know, from when all of that was happening. So this idea that the world is a safe place and everything's going to be fine. I mean, you know, that's I talked about that in another interview, but not to beat it into the ground. But the notion that everything's safe, that the world's a safe place, is kind of uniquely American.
Well,
because if you live in the Middle East, you live in Central America or South America, you live even in Europe, you know, if you live in Russia or China, the world's never been a safe place.
Right. Well, anybody who's, you know, been alive and knows about Hurricane Katrina ought to see what happens.
Yeah.
The people that are tasked with taking care of the public turn against the public. Because it's chaos. It's chaotic. The systems are failing everywhere. People are afraid. And so law and order breaks.
It gets really, real dangerous. And remember, that was just a regional issue.
Exactly.
Like that was, okay, this storm devastated this area, you know, New Orleans, Mississippi, that old. But,
sure.
You know, now imagine if that's the entire country. And, you know, we've moved more towards a police state anyway, where there's this adversarial sort of, you know, the population is the enemy and we're the armed guys with the military equipment. So there's an adversarial tension there anyway that's sort of developed and escalated over the last 20, 30 years. So now imagine when it becomes, you know, all hell is breaking loose and chaos and people are dying and, you know, they've all got guns.
And sure.
So, I mean, it's just it's a fascinating future to sort of mine for me.
I understand that. After Hurricane Andrew, when I was living in Miami, the most shocking thing to me was seeing armed military on the streets. And I had lived in Miami all my life and had been through plenty of hurricanes, but none that I remember is devastating. Of course, there have been devastating hurricanes, but to see military armed on the streets and patrolling in neighborhoods freaked me out.
Yeah, see, now
quite
I'm
honestly.
Used to that because in Mexico, you know, they have a completely different perspective. You know, it's kind of like because of the war on drugs and all of that. You know, I'm very accustomed to seeing soldiers, you know, to roadblocks, to seeing guys with machine guns. But I remember when I lived in Europe, you know, back in God, that was probably the late 70s when the Bottom Meinhof and all of that was going on, the Red Brigade.
Sure.
You know, it freaked me out to see, you know, guys standing on the street corner with an Uzi. You know, that's kind of weird.
In Italy, it was commonplace outside all the banks and in the piazzas and all. You would see that in the airports and so on. You saw it all the time.
Yeah, and you know, so they had, you know, kind of more of a zero tolerance thing, you know. But again, that's all part of the American psyche where, you know, things are going to be okay and it's safe. But all you have to do is look at what happened in Katrina to see on a regional basis where that all falls apart. And the freaky part is how quickly it falls apart. I mean,
well,
that's the thing that just, you know, that's the most fascinating.
And you and I have talked about this in the past, but I've asked a lot of listeners and readers, you know, when the systems collapse after a climate disaster, and even though they're regional, are you prepared to take care of yourself? And most people say no, but I expect the government to take care of me. And I'm really disheartened when I hear things like that.
Well, that's completely new. That's a completely new perspective, and it's post-Great Depression and World War II. And because it might be, you know, the New Deal was sold, government as daddy, he's going to take care of you, he'll be there to protect you. You know, people forgot that the original government of the Democratic Republic was there basically to provide like 19, you know, services. You know, mail, you know, build roads, make sure that, you know, that there was an army to defend in case we were directly attacked. You know, we sort of, the U.S. Farmed out defense, for instance, of the high seas to the British Crown. So, right. So it, you know, the federal government originally started out as a very small services organization where the customer was the states. So the states, you know, basically would pay the government services corporation to deal with the stuff that was in the national interest to do.
Right.
But that completely transitioned now to where it's an organization that is supposed to basically provide for everything. Like when you look at the Great Depression, there was no safety net. There were bread lines.
Right.
People were starving to death. And, yes. You know, post-World War II, you know, there's this socialistic thing that happened in the U.S. with Roosevelt, you know, brought in, okay, you know, he basically brought in socialism, stopped, you know, democracy was a four-letter word up until Roosevelt got into office and basically brought in socialism. And he changed the structure of the United States from a democratic republic where the rights of the sovereign individual were absolutely they were preeminent and they were unalienable. It wasn't like, you know, you needed the Constitution to give you those rights. You had those rights.
You were born with them. Right.
The Constitution merely elucidated and formalized them so that it was clear to the government that, you know, don't step over this line. So it was basically just a charter to say, hey, you guys can't do this. That completely transformed in the 30s because, you know, Roosevelt basically brought in socialism. So suddenly, you know, you have the government's there to create jobs, the government's there to make work, the government's there to take care of, you know, those that don't have food, that, you know, I mean, so it became sort of this nanny state and, you know, it encroached and encroached and encroached until now. I mean, I think the reason that a future calamity, you know, at least in my you know sort of vision of the future, the reason it's interesting and it's set in the U.S. versus someplace else is because I really believe the U.S. is very ill prepared for a future where, you know, the electricity doesn't come out of the wall, the water doesn't come out of the pipes, the gas doesn't get, you know, it doesn't come through the pipes. Food isn't over in the market. I mean, it's a country where you, you know, and I've said this before, but it's a country where you can buy food 24/7. You don't, you're never in a situation where you can't get whatever the hell you want when you want it. There's just
no
way that happens.
A lot of waste too, and that's even worse.
It creates tremendous waste, but it also creates it's conditioning. Look, you do anything for 30 days, and it becomes a habit. Like you want to quit smoking, stop putting cigarettes in your mouth for 30 days. Guess what? Now you're not going to be smoking. I mean, so you apply that to if you condition people to believe everything that they hear in the media, you condition them to expect that the government's going to take care of them no matter what, that the world is a safe place. Pretty soon they're conditioned to believe that. And the problem is it doesn't reflect reality.
Right.
So now you have where beliefs intersect with reality, and that never ends well for the people that have beliefs that are out of touch with reality,
out of sync with what is really happening. I will say that when I was reading the book, you have one main character whom I really like. He's not he's nobody's hero. He's just an everyman. And however, in his character and the good guys in this book kind of remind me of the pioneer days when people really had to be self-sufficient. Did I get that wrong?
Yeah, no, I mean, that was the whole reason that I sort of wrote him as, you know, the reason I situated it where I did in Texas and New Mexico is because I kind of wanted that bleak, no country for old men kind of feel to it. And I also wanted, you know, sort of the reluctant hero who's a loner, who's, you know, sort of, you know, he's sort of pushed into situations that he really would rather not be in. And he's self-sufficient by virtue of the fact of, you know, of where he lives. Like, you know, he's not living in San Diego or in you know, Minneapolis. He's living out, you know, close to the Mexican border.
Right.
It's basically desert. You know, so he's got to be a little bit more game on in terms of just, you know, survival skills than a city dweller. So
yes.
I want to plug that guy into a future where, you know, at most of the casualties he sees are the people that just weren't prepared. They just
right.
thought it could never happen because they were told it could never happen.
Right.
And here's, you know,
right.
shocker, governments and the media tend to lie a lot. When they don't want people to panic, when they don't want people to storm the stores and
right.
hoard food or money or whatever, they lie.
But of course,
they stretch
you
the
know,
truth.
When you're in a hurricane pathway, town, city, country, whatever it happens to be, if a storm brews in the sea, they go berserk, and everybody, of course, does storm the stores. When the storm actually happens, they're calling for quiet and calm. So, you know, there's not a lot of rational thinking. And I discount the media completely on things like that. I want to just take a moment to remind everyone, if you want to call in Dr. Russell, 347-633-609. The switchboard is open. I can't promise you that he's not going to give you a Jell-O shot. You may not get one, you know, yellow Jell-O shot. You might be sure
I'm sitting here
on
drinking
this.
An excellent, like, you know, medium body beer called León, which is, it's got about 5% alcohol. So it's got a little kick to it.
There you go. And I'm drinking a hard apple cider, which is not too shabby.
You had me at hard.
You know. Good stuff. All right. So let's move on to something else. Let's move on to Jet. What are you on, Jet 37 or something right now?
It seems that way.
It does seem like that. I couldn't figure out how to get all the books in one JPEG. It just wasn't happening. I would have had to take up about, you know, five or six Facebook covers. You're not giving up on Jet. I know that because that's your most popular
book. Well, no, I was actually kind of going, okay, I'm going to retire her in this next book and then we're done, you know, move on to something else because I got a lot of other stuff that I kind of want to write. But, you know, what happened was readers just were absolutely outraged. They were like, you can't do that. So there's a lot of people emotionally invested in what's going to happen with Jet and Hannah and the whole gang. And,
sure.
you know, I was sort of told in no uncertain terms by hundreds of readers that I was a complete asshat for even thinking about ending it.
Right.
So, you know, when the readers speak, I tend to listen.
You have well, and that's the smart writer. And it's doing well as also in Kindle Worlds. I notice that you have a lot of really great names that are writing in the Jet series in Kindle Worlds. And they're getting good reviews too. And some of the women who are writing are getting exceptional reviews, which I really like seeing that. So congratulations on that. But you did you did say that you were planning to retire a few series that you had. I think the last time you were here, we talked about this. You said, I've got to end some of them.
Yeah, no, I retired the Assassin series. I did a sort of ending to the Assassin series. So that's over. And then, you know, Black is kind of the type of series that I write whenever I don't have anything else, you know, like on the front burner, you know, or I'm just feeling particularly – I have to be in the right mood to write Black.
Yeah, it's a great series.
I have to be sort of whimsical, ha-ha-ha, funny, you know, just don't give a shit kind of mood to write one of those books. So that happens whenever I basically, you know, I'm going a little stir-crazy, I don't have a project, and I'm in the right mood. So those two, you know – Assassin, you've seen everything you're going to see of that, which is, you know, I mean, I still get people going, no, you can't do that. It's like, look, you know, this is not 24 where it goes, you know, 10 seasons. Okay.
Right. Right.
Like, you know,
right.
There's only so many hours in a day to write. So I kind of have to prioritize what am I going to write? So I've got the Ramsey series going. I've got this new series, the post-op series with The Day After Never. I've got the Black series and I've got the Jet series. Well, you know, and I've got Fatal Exchange and Fatal Deception have you know, legs, and I'll probably need to write another in that series. So that's an awful lot of series to come up with at least one per year to keep it alive.
And then, well, and then also you want to try new things like The Day After Never. And
yeah.
So it makes it, every time I talk to you, say, I'm not going to do that many again this year.
No,
I'm
I know.
Really,
my editor has given up now. She thought that she could make me an honest man, but she's not the first one that failed in that. So.
There you go. And she should be happy. She's making money. She only needs you as a client
way
that
she but, you know, that's a double-edged sword, if you ask her. That's, you know, there's positives and negatives to that.
I don't know.
No, but this year I'll probably come out with like 8 or 9 books, and I swore I'd only do 5. So there you go.
Yeah, well, you lied.
I lied the year before.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I don't believe it.
Are you starting to see a pattern here?
Yeah, you know, listen, how often do we talk to each other? I know the pattern. So we've got now the dystopian book, the Day After Never, and you think 4 books. I think it should be 5 because I like uneven numbers. I think those are lucky numbers.
It's 27, but I mean.
Well, I know that's the Jet series, 33 or something. Or,
yeah,
you know,
no, it's gonna go. It's gonna go a while. This one might go a while too because the character's pretty. I mean, he's developing now, and so are the secondary characters. So
yeah.
It feels like there's more story. I originally saw this as a trilogy, but now I think it's 4 books because there's no way I can pack it all into, you know, 3 volumes. So I think it'll be 4 for this sort of entire arc to play itself out. And then the question is after that, all right, do I keep going? Do I embark on a new adventure? You know, how are the relationships developed? You know, who's still left standing? Who isn't? There's a lot of interesting questions, and it'll all be based on, you know, obviously sales, and it's doing well. So right now I am very optimistic about it, but also I don't want to beat a dead horse. No pun intended, given that there's
no, I understand that since there are horses and those are critical to the story. So
yeah, but I mean, why write something that isn't fresh?
Well,
you know,
I
if you're tired of it and you're bored and, you know, go on, move on.
Right. So when you're looking at a new story like this, like the series for The Day After Never, I know that you're working on the 3rd book already. So my question is, do you map out kind of where you see each book going?
I had a complete idea of the entire arc that would range over 3 books. Like, you know, I kind of each one, you know, book 2 is, you know, I originally thought was going to be a road book, but it didn't really turn into as much of a road book as I had originally conceived of it. But, you know, book 3 was going to be the conclusion. And then I came up with another pretty compelling plot point that, you know, I just kind of went, you know what, that's worth it's worth exploring. So, you know, I mean, I leave myself open to the unexpected, but I'm pretty, you know, I'm pretty good about following and creating a template. And that's why I'm able to create as much the volume of work that I do, that and the, you know, all the like dwarves I have down in the cellar that are turning stuff out.
Right.
But thank God for the boiler room in Bangalore. Cause
otherwise, there you go. There you go. That is something to consider.
I do, you know, I have a pretty good idea of where it's going to go on this one. On Jet, I really didn't. I kind of knew where the first 3 or 4 books were going to go, and then I had no idea what else was going to happen.
Yeah, well, Jet, you know, Jet saved the world how many times, and I guess she's going to continue to save it, so.
Well, that's like Jack Bauer, though. I mean, you know, what kind of show is it, you know, Jack Bauer discovers that, you know, there's a colon cancer scare. Well, okay, that's not really what people tune into 24 for. So.
Right.
It's like, you know, if he's not shooting people within the first 5 minutes, there's something really wrong.
Exactly. No, I get that, although I don't own a television, so I'm going to take your word for it. Are you still doing author interviews on your website?
Nah, I stopped doing that about 2 years ago because it just, you know, again, number of hours in the day.
Right.
I just don't have time. And, you know, I kind of was overwhelmed with all these people that wanted to do it. And I was like, you know, there's so many other people that are doing it better than I can. You know, if you have to choose, you know, of your list of 20 things you're going to do this year, that didn't make the top 20. So it was like,
well, there you go.
No thanks.
I noticed that about every 6 months to a year, sorry, I'm moving around here. Every 6 months to a year, you kind of change up the genre that you're writing in. Now, I can always say that it's action adventure, whatever the story is going to be, whether it's, you know, the caper stories of Ramsey, whether it's dystopian in The Day After Never. Are you still looking to change it up?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've been blessed in the sense that I have enough of a readership now that they trust me enough to go into another genre. So
right.
That's something that you don't really have when you're, you know, in the first year or two as you're an author. You don't have that flexibility. So I believe it's a terrible mistake to sort of genre jump when you're until you got a big readership. Once you have a big readership and you understand what it is, you know, if you understand your audience and your readership and why they're reading your stuff versus somebody else's, I think you can be a little more flexible. And as long as you don't jump the shark, you know, you can, you know, because, for instance, the dystopian thing, it's like, yeah, okay, that's different, but it's not that different. I mean, it's still a Russell Blake book. So you have all the pacing, you know, you have the character development, you have all the stuff that you would read me for, whether it's a mystery or, you know, any of the books. So, you know,
they're moving along at a pretty fast clip.
Well, I don't suffer, you know, paragraphs and chapters where nothing happens. I just, you know, if there's nothing happening, what the hell is it doing there?
Right.
It's like, you know, that's just lazy writing.
I think that your dialogue is very economical, especially in this book. And that.
Yeah, well, that's the characters.
Right. And that is, I think that lends itself because of the type of story it is. But like in Ramsey, there's a lot more dialogue, but it is pushing the story forward. In this book, there isn't, but the action doesn't stop. There's movement all the time.
Well, thanks, but I mean, you know why? It's because this is a bleak future, so people aren't really, you know, loquacious. They aren't, you know, giddy and quipping, and you know, they're kind of shit. Cool. I may be dead tomorrow, so
well, a lot of them are gone.
Not
a lot of them are
already energy dead. On interaction.
And he and Lucas is he's a loner anyway, and he reluctantly takes up with other people, and he's suspicious of everyone, so it doesn't lend itself to a lot of dialogue anyway, but you still keep it moving pretty fast. I have to say our reviewers love the book. I love the book. It's 5 stars in my humble opinion, and you know, I read all your stuff, so
well, you're a pretty tough crowd, actually.
Well,
no, you are. You read more than just about anybody I know. So if you go, yeah, this doesn't suck too bad, you know, I'm like, okay, well, maybe I did something right.
No, but you know, listen, at least if you ask me, I'm honest about it. I never BS you whenever you ask me about a book. So, and you and I've gone back and forth
just
on
about everything else.
Yeah, I know.
No, in fact, I'm reading your Authors on the Air Global Radio Network byline says fascinating guests and intelligent commentary. And I'm thinking, what am I doing on here?
Right. Well,
who are you talking about?
This is, you know, this is spring break. What can I tell you?
Okay. All right. So I'm just a pretty face. I'm just, I just fill out my top well. Okay. I got it.
I've said, listen, you want to go back to the jalapeno heat or, you know,
a jalapeno heat? You know, I can be eye candy. If that's
you
what
could
I got
to do. All right. So, so let's talk about the elephant in the room. What the hell?
The prison shower scene?
Yes, but that and the big change of your look. What is going on there? Yeah,
what do you mean? My covers?
Yeah, the profile pictures, baby. You know,
my selfies?
Here you are.
One, I've got a baseball cap. The other one, I'm like, you know, giving, you know, my Terminator glare. What's
exactly? I'm like comparing them side by side with the magnifying glass, saying, I don't even know if this is the same guy.
No, it's the same guy. One, I was more drunk than in the other.
Ah, okay, there you go.
No, the one with the baseball cap was over at a nightclub, and actually, you know, a buddy of mine took the picture on his phone. It was that was probably at 1 a.m.
Oh, wonderful. So, okay, so but the other one is really more you. It's just that you wanted to update it, right? You didn't have the glasses on. It scared me. I didn't know what was going on. I thought,
Well, everybody bitches and moans. You can't make everyone happy. It's like, oh, we want to see your eyes. And I'm like, no, you don't. Yeah, you'll turn to stone. Yeah, you really don't. Yeah. You'll get that icky kind of, you know, sketchy weasel feeling that you get when you have, like, you know, a used car salesman on his last leg. Like, he's
there
getting fired at the end of the day if you don't buy this piece of junk. Well, that's what I look like most of the time. So.
All right. There, I don't believe it for a second. Do you know
you're
– I don't. It's true. You know, you talk a lot about being on your Stairmaster with your – keyboard attached to it and
treadmill.
More and more your treadmill, Stairmaster, treadmill, they're all the same to me.
Except for the stairs in the middle part. Yeah.
Well, you know, they're not things I ever get near.
Okay.
So I have seen a lot of authors who are now replicating your writing process via the treadmill and having a built in computer on it. I'm wondering, isn't that difficult to walk and type at the same time?
Nah, it's easy. It just seems like it would be, but I mean, it took me like a day and a half to get acclimated. It's not like I'm racing along at 10 miles per hour. I mean, I'm walking along at a couple miles per hour, so it's, you know, it's a moderate walking pace. So it's really not that hard. In fact, I feel like it actually does me a lot of good because, you know, you're oxygenating, your lymphatic system is moving around, you know, everything's doing what it's supposed to do. So, you know, I find that I write better when I'm in motion now, which, you know, is paradoxical. Doesn't mean everybody would be, but it does. You know, it's your brain's working better because you're moving. And, you know, you got arms and legs, so you weren't designed to sit in one place for 14 hours a day. You just weren't.
This is true. Sometimes my fanny's super glued to the sofa, so I understand that. I can't help it, you know, when you produce 12 shows, and then you're trying to bring three or four more. I'm stuck in front of a virtual studio all the time. For those of you who don't know, Authors on the Air, I hope you realize, is an internet radio talk show. And yes, there is a virtual studio. I don't go anywhere. I sit in my jammies on the sofa, and that's how I broadcast. So there you
go. Okay, so that's when I hear like 9 cats in the background. That's what
five.
That's
what
going.
It is. Whenever we're
okay.
chatting, that's what it is. They're
okay.
calling for food.
I do hear them every now and then.
I know you do. I know you do. All right. What's next? What are you going to be doing next? What's next for Russell Blake over the next, I don't know, 3 months?
Well, I'm thinking of taking up heroin. That seems like a good idea. I mean, there's a lot of it around, so what the heck? And I'm at an age where I feel like I'm cheating myself if I say no to anything. So
there you go.
Might as well add that to the bucket list.
There you go.
I don't know. I mean, I'm probably going to finish up. I'm sort of driven to finish up this Day After Never 4 books, and I'll probably release another Ramses, you know, somewhere in the summer or early fall. And I'm going to write at least one Jet book this year, maybe two. So, and I've got the mother of all conspiracy novels that I'm sort of kicking around in my head and whether I want to actually write it or not, because I kind of don't want to, you know, kind of drone strike, you know, in my
Yeah, because let's face it, you are an expat, so it could happen.
Well, yeah, and I just don't want that. Oh, he was an enemy combatant. It's like, look, I wasn't even arguing. Okay,
there you go. You're agreeing with it all.
Yeah, it's like, look, I, you know, I don't even have a beard. Okay, leave me alone.
So, there you go.
No, but I mean, if I don't write that book, and I probably won't. Because it just seems like a bad idea. So what is that? I mean, 1, 2, 3, you know, I'll probably release 4 or 5 more books this year.
Good grief.
No, it's going to be over 50. It'll be like 53, 54 books by the end of the year. So yikes.
Listen, if they're selling, that's all that matters. If you're having a good time, I was reading your website today. You said, you know, you're really happy with your writing on. I'm the one who clicked on today. You said that you were really happy with The Day After Never. You thought it was some of your best writing, and I agree, it is some of your best writing. In some places, even though this is your classic action book, I don't mean that there is a lot of physical action, but there is a lot of movement in the story. I do believe there's a lot of nuanced prose there.
I'm glad that came through, because I mean, that was, look, you know, for me, writing something that's like this happens and then this happens and then this happens, that's fairly easy. I mean, I've written enough books that, you know, I know how to put, you know, plot A, plot B, plot C, and move them along.
Sure.
But doing it where there, it seems like there's a musicality to it, where there's some nuance, where you're not, you know, ham-fisted and bludgeoning the reader with the obvious. You're giving them some credit for being bright. That's a little harder to do and pull off, because now you're treading into, you know, I don't want to say literary fiction territory, but you're certainly, you know, you're moving into that Cormac McCarthy, James Lee Burke kind of, you know, is this a thriller, or am I reading something that's got a little more substance to it? And that's what I was hoping for when I was writing the book. I was trying to make it a little bit more than just, you know, all this shit happens, and then this other shit happens. The end, by the next book.
Well, you know, as you know,
I've had a lot of people send me emails saying that I should write westerns. I'm like, well, yeah. Other than the fact that I don't, A, they don't sell, and B, I don't really know anything about the Wild Wild West. Yeah. Other than that, it'd be a great idea.
It'd be a great idea, right? And they're so popular now.
Yeah, but it's funny, because I'm number one in Westerns right now, and all the other books are like, you know, have a cowboy with his shirt off, you know.
Right,
and,
of course.
Know, he was the bad cowboy, and she
those
was
the alpha Westerns. Those are the alpha Westerns.
The strong-willed, you know, mistress that took over the ranch. Together, their burning love will scorch the desert. Yeah.
Hey, but you know,
way,
you may have missed your calling.
Series right there.
There you go. See, you may have missed your calling.
funny. I think you can say that about a lot of things.
I appreciate it, Russell. Mm. Thanks for being with me again. I really appreciate it. It's,
you know, it's
a
nice to have a woman thank me for being with her. You know, once every 10 years, that's good.
Now you
wonder why I come on every quarter. It's like, well,
there you go. I can't handle it if you come on anymore. I'm always fearful that, you know, you're going to push me over the edge.
Well, you haven't given me enough time.
I know. Did you notice that the interviews are shorter now every time you come on?
Yeah, no, well, it just seems that way. That's why I'm talking faster now.
I see that.
Right. I'm trying to get all in. It's like,
thank you, Russell. I really appreciate it. Good luck with The Day After Never. It is a spectacular book. I urge everyone to go and buy it now. And please, whatever you do, leave a damn review for the author if you like the book. If you don't,
unless you think it sucks. Yeah. If your review is "It blows goats," you know, you should die. Well, maybe leave that one off.
Right. So don't troll authors. You know, give an honest review. If it's not your cup of tea, just say, it doesn't work for me, and that's it. But go and review books. It's really important. It's important for a lot of different reasons, but mostly because you get to say thank you to an author who spent, you know, months providing this entertainment for you.
Yeah, and it gives the NSA a lot more stuff to have to collect. So you're creating jobs.
The more stuff you put up there, the better. Russell needs the firewall. So go ahead.
Be sure to put jihad and, you know, plague and a bunch of other stuff in every review. Just to mix it up a
government incompetency. No.
There you go. Well, that's an oxymoron, isn't it?
No. Competency would be the oxymoron.
<That's true. laughs>
Thanks very much, Russell. I'll talk to you again in about 3 or 4 months.
Thanks,
Russell. Talk to you later.
Me.
Absolutely.
Right.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
And that's our show for tonight. Next week starts a new month of all kinds of wonderful authors going to be on. We're kicking off with, I have a debut novelist named Dave Pupa who's going to be on, another debut novelist, Tom Fox, with a book called Dominus. It's amazing. On Wednesday the 4th, Alex Gilley, another debut novelist thriller. And then I'm going to introduce you to Catherine Jane, who writes romance. She's a Canadian author. We have got a stellar lineup in May. Steve Conkley's coming back, Jeff Crawford, John McGoran, Ward Larson. Now that's going to be fun. Allison Liotta wrote a spectacular book. And then Allison Brennan and Tony McGee-Causey in conversation with each other. Skid Row Chatter brings on Joe Clifford about his new book with December Boys. And then I'm going to speak to a man named Raymond Arroyo. It's really interesting. Have a good weekend, everyone. Thanks for listening. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.